case number 4, United States against Holm.
May it please this court, counsel. I'm going to focus most of my arguments on the overbreadth issue. The defendant in this case never had a chance to prove his claim that he was possessing incident to legitimate inquiry. Even the Ferber case.
This is his PhD thesis idea, you know, that he's studying child pornography?
Essentially, yes. He is a techie, a computer techie involved. He may have even done computer work for this honorable court. He is involved in some of the public policy analysis, and yes, that's what he maintains he was doing. Even the
Why is that a defense, given the language of the statute?
Well, the Ferber case even allows case-by-case analysis where there could be an overbreadth problem. The statute is pretty clear. It says that nobody is to possess child pornography. But I think the statute goes too far, and that argument has been given new life in light of the recent decision of Ashcroft versus Free Speech Coalition.
But wait, why do you think Ashcroft against Free Speech helps you so much? There's no question here about virtual child pornography.
Correct. But some of the same issues that came up in Ashcroft, and I've listed about 8 of them in my brief, show up. Speech, you know, the First Amendment cannot dictate what we see, read, or hear. Ashcroft talks about speech that could be prohibited by a statute despite serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. For example,
but
medical
text. Ferber, I mean, the thing is, there's Ferber, which is not overruled by Free Speech Coalition, which identifies child pornography. It's an area of special concern, you know, of the Congress and for the state, child victims, you know, actual child victims. And whatever your rights may be with respect to information in general, adults don't have the right to have hundreds of thousands of files of child pornography on their computers.
That's correct. Under the statute, persons don't. But even Ferber says, whatever overbreadth may exist should be cured through case-by-case analysis of the fact situations to which extensions certainly may not be applied.
In other words, as applied, not on its face. And there's the issue with Mr. Holm, where he has all of this, you know, child pornography, and he wants it to be a defense that he was studying it instead of viewing it with some different state of mind. I don't see where that comes into the statute.
Well, that I guess
anyone's
that's my point.
Studying it.
That's my point. He wanted to challenge and investigate and see whether there's a basis to challenge. Where is this pornography coming from? Does the government really need to protect children from it? When did this pornography become a problem? There is some legitimacy to studying the history of it so that we can, as citizens, find a solution to the problem.
But the government may take the position that that's not true outside the law enforcement context.
That's correct. But even if we compare this to even drug prescription, even the drug cocaine, that it is a controlled substance. And there are exceptions in the law where we can use, doctors can use it for medical purposes, study it, same with marijuana. And that is where this statute is overbroad. It
very
does not
few exceptions for marijuana.
That's correct. Very few exceptions, but there are some. There are.
And aren't there certainly procedures in order to be covered under those exceptions? And certainly you're not arguing here that your client got permission from anybody.
No, he didn't. The statute goes too far. It doesn't allow any exceptions for that type of study. In fact, even if he was a law enforcement officer, he would not have protection by the statute. Nowhere does that give any protection for legitimate inquiry or as part of public discourse.
So you're saying law enforcement officials that are currently surveying the internet and finding this child pornography are not protected and they would be in violation of this?
Absolutely. In fact, it has been a concern for public defenders in the state of California defending people, court-appointed public defenders, that they were violating the statute. So certain court orders had to be set up to protect them.
But isn't there, I mean, the district court considered that argument,
yes.
relied, as I recall, on a district court decision from another district, which had considered it and rejected it, basically found that there's a privilege for law enforcement activities, which isn't uncommon. You know, you don't slander in opinions either, and there are all kinds of things where laws are seemingly of general applicability, but it's understood that court proceedings and associated matters aren't covered.
That is correct. There was that. I'm not sure if that's binding on the particular district court in this instance.
No, I mean, but it's before us now if we say that's the way it is.
Yes, it is. But beyond that, for just the basics of litigating those issues, a citizen doesn't have the right to use scientific principles to analyze, is there a problem? What is the solution to the problem?
That's right. Just as a citizen doesn't have the right to say, I decided to grow this field of marijuana because I think I can find a legitimate medical use for cannabis plants.
But there's
that would not move any prosecutor I can think of.
Correct. It would not. But there is a difference. Those statutes dealing with marijuana and cocaine, which are, cocaine is a controlled substance. There are exceptions in the law for legitimate medical study.
Well,
and
as Judge Williams points out, they're regulated.
Another problem with the statute, and this comes right out of the Ashcroft decision, is if you take an excerpt from a legitimate medical journal, it can be twisted in a way to create a piece of child pornography. And that's the problem that Ashcroft pointed out with the statute, is you have to look at the work as a whole. In fact, there was a short film showing a young girl being brutally attacked and tortured. If you look at that film as a whole, its message was anti-abuse, showing the problems of what's happening in another country. But somehow somebody got on the internet, put this out in just excerpt form, and that became child pornography.
Well, why not? I mean, it's not true in every area of the law that you have something like the obscenity test where you've got to evaluate the material as a whole. If the only thing you have, even if it's from a medical textbook, is the single thing that could be viewed as falling within the language of the statute, then why is there a problem with calling that child pornography?
Well, I guess that's my point. That is wrong. Okay, to not look at the Miller standard of looking at the problem as a whole.
But what if there is no whole anymore? Somebody, you can do anything practically with digital internet files. You can excerpt. You can, eliminate all the rest of the supposedly redeeming parts of the work. And if the only thing you're transmitting is the bad part, why doesn't that become the whole, if you will?
That is correct. You can twist that. But Ferber took an analysis of, substantial overbreadth. And they basically said, there may be a good use for this, spreading a good message, but, the policy of protecting children overrides all of that. But still, on a case-by-case analysis, we should allow that. You can take any good thing, a microphone here, and you can turn that into a weapon.
So why is Mr. Holm the one that, on a case-by-case analysis, wins? I mean, it seems to me if the only thing he's saying is he was trying to study this stuff, that's pretty weak, and it's not like he falls within any of these other exceptions, people with little tiny, three files or, the other kinds of arguments that are made.
The statute didn't afford him anything whatsoever, any exception.
Because
I think our legislature went too broad. Our legislature should have made specific exceptions for, perhaps licensed person. You apply for it, you work with law enforcement to investigate it properly, put some restrictions on it. Our legislature went too far in saying no one, anyone, can ever possess anything like this, with the exception of three or two or less matters, which doesn't make any sense to me. Any other questions on that issue? Another issue came up is the Fifth Amendment issue. yeah, I guess there is an exception in there, that if you bring it to somebody's attention immediately, if you download something. But again, that
but
has
that's
you...
so far from Mr. Holmes' case. Maybe you should talk about the sentencing guidelines.
Certainly.
Point
certainly.
That you were making.
Mr. Holmes was sentenced under one provision of the guideline that actually focuses on persons who are into manufacturing, possessing with intent to traffic, distribution, or the direct sexual abuse or exploitation of a minor. He only possessed it. There was no evidence in the record that he manufactured it, distributed it, sold it, profited from it, or had any behavior directly relating to any minor.
Now, the whole issue here is the cross-reference, though, back to 2G2.2, right?
Yes, correct.
Because I don't think anybody disagreed that, at least in terms of tagging base, you started at 2G2.4.
Right.
But then, according to the government, you go to the cross-reference subpart, and that takes you back to 2G2.2.
Right.
Because he received.
Exactly. And one of the things this honorable court has noted admire is increased precautions may be necessary where there is this cross-referencing. And the court abused its discretion in going too far. Yes, I guess the court could have cross-referenced, but it had really nothing to do with what my client did. He had nothing other than his own possession. That's all he did in this case. Any other questions on those issues?
If you would like to save rebuttal time, it's up to you. If you'd like to use it now.
If I may. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Campbell?
Excuse me. May it please the court and counsel? I'm John Campbell. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Central District of Illinois and Peoria Division. I'd like to address the overbreadth issue briefly if the court has already discussed.
Mr. Campbell, that would be fine, but I wonder if you could perhaps first talk about the sentencing guideline issue, because this is a problem that this court keeps circling around, and this case presents, as far as I was able to tell, a slightly different wrinkle from Richardson and Ellison, in that here the only statute under which Mr. Holmes was convicted, if I'm correct, was 2252A4.
Correct.
Well, of course, in Richardson, the individual had been convicted under both 2252A2 and A4. And the opinion comments that it would be somewhat perverse to let that kind of individual be sentenced under 2G2.4, the lighter of the two, since he was convicted for the more serious offense. And then there's some discussion, I think really more in the nature of dicta, or might be dicta, about trying to deal with this issue about receiving versus possessing. And I'll tell you just in a nutshell something that I never have been comfortable with, which is that the government's reading of 2G2.4 as applied to Mr. Holmes, where we take the cross-reference as soon as we find he received pornographic materials and we go back to 2G2.2, I think reads 2G2.4 completely out of the guideline, because I don't know how you can possess unless you either produced it yourself or you received it from someone else. Am I missing a way of possessing that doesn't involve either production or receipt?
Well, just to back up for a second, the Ellison case, I think you're correct, is not quite on point in this instance. Actually, it's the reverse of this, where a conviction was for the receipt, and the argument was I should only be sentenced on possession.
Right.
So it's a similar topic, but it's not exactly
not
the same thing.
Not quite the same.
No. The situation here, and maybe some of the facts in this case would assist the court. I don't know. Let me try that.
Could you just tell me logically, to answer my first question, whether it's possible to have child pornography in your possession if you neither received it from somebody nor produced it yourself?
Well, that's what I was getting to. This case, I think, allows an explanation of that, or an example of that. This case is this. the defendant and his wife and his adult son all lived in the house. The computer was in a common area in the basement. They all had access to that room. They all had access to the computer. In fact, the son, the adult son, had used the computer for video games and whatever else. He admitted to the police when they went there to check this out to see what the problem was. The wife admitted that from time to time she would use the computer, but neither of them, of course, were necessarily implicated in the child pornography, the images contained on the computer. But next to the computer, when the police went there to investigate this tip that they received, were handwritten notes. Those notes, and also a stack of printed out material that was child pornography that had been on the computer. There was a correlation between the handwritten notes and some of those items that had been printed out with the files, the arrangement of the files in the computer and the actual images in the computer. Now, we were comfortable in charging possession, but the evidence was that in this case, the computer specialist, the experts, could not determine when or how the material got into the computer, because there were also disks and diskettes there that contained many of, if not all, the same type of material. The point is that because it looked
it's
like...
It's not receipt if somebody hands you a 3.5 floppy?
Yeah, well, it is, but...
I don't see why the medium, whether it's a printout or it's a CD-ROM or it's a floppy or it's a direct digital download, why did that make a difference for receipt?
Well, it wasn't a direct digital download. It was done by way of modem. And the point is that it looked like the computer that was examined for forensic analysis, it looked like in 1999 a whole flood of information was put into the computer quicker and much faster than it could ever be downloaded with a modem. The point is, okay, someone had to receive it, someone had to send it. How do I prove as a prosecutor who received it in the household with three adults? We know from the handwritten notes, which the son, the adult son, and the wife would say that's the defendant's handwriting on those notes. And then we, by inference, can say those notes, which listed file numbers and names, the series of these child pornography images, correlate to what's in the computer. We can show that he possessed either by way of images in the computer or printed out material. That's child pornography, too. So our case included both. And the fact is that he possessed it, and that's what we could
charge. All right, if that's true, and then that's why you decide to charge him under 2252A4. A4B. Why is it that you now feel that you can prove that he received for purposes of the cross-reference?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question.
Because first of all, I'm still not fully satisfied that let's say receipt in the passive voice, you know, isn't enough, because somehow or another, whether he received it indirectly from the outside via his wife or his son, or whether he received it directly by his modem or somebody handing him a floppy, somehow or another, it seems to me he still has to have received it if he didn't produce it.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but my perspective is from proving beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury that he, in fact, received it. If I charge receipt, I have to prove receipt.
Right.
If I charge possession, that's all I have to prove. I could not depend upon the adult son or the wife to turn. Maybe they didn't even know, didn't know that he, in fact, had received, because they didn't observe him receiving it. So there is at best an inference that he received it. But at the time that the defendant pled guilty, there was no written plea agreement, but at that time, the court asked the defendant, what is it that you've done in this instance that says that you are guilty of possessing this child pornography? You know, and they went through the, you know, how old were the people, what they do and all that. But the defendant then says, I downloaded it. So for the defendant's own words, at that point, established that he received it. And for purposes of sentencing, and I think that's what the guideline direction is for, if you have a mere possession case, and that's all you can prove, that's all the sentence you get. And we couldn't prove the receipt at the trial. It wasn't until he admits to the court at the time that he pled guilty, yes, in fact, I downloaded. At that point, downloading is received.
I think Judge Wood has asked a good question about what's the role of 2G2.4 at this point. You're virtually reading it out of the guidelines, I think. I don't think anybody here cited in the brief was Amendment 372, which when 2G2.4 was inserted into the guideline. says this amendment inserts an additional guideline at 2G2.4 to address offenses involving receipt or possession of materials depicting a minor engaged in sexually explicit conduct as distinguished from offenses involving trafficking in such materials, which continue to be covered by 2G2.2. Now, doesn't that answer to make a pretty clear distinction that should all be followed here?
I guess...
Doesn't this have any weight at this point, or what?
Well, I'm not saying it doesn't, Your Honor, but the opposite of that, or the reverse of that, is that you have to ignore the direction in 2G2.4C2.
That direction is if the offense involves trafficking.
Well, what's the definition of trafficking? It includes receiving.
We have been through this in many cases, but I'm just saying there would be a rational way to read the word trafficking that would cover some possession offenses, but not 100% of them.
Well, I guess...
Or with the exception of the small percentage that are under 2G2.1, which is the production guideline.
Correct.
It's not enough to say that, oh, well, you might possess because you produced it, because there's a different guideline for that. You still have erased 2G2.4.
I guess I would perceive a problem of ignoring the fact that trafficking in this C2 includes the term receiving, and the fact that courts have identified receiving or receipt of child pornography as more of a problem because it actually spreads the sexual exploitation of the child or children who are depicted. It spreads them beyond, and actually, of course, we know, all over the world once it hits the Internet, and that makes it a more egregious type of a problem. So I think the guidelines try to draw a distinction between mere possession and receipt, and someone who has possession and has received is more blameworthy than someone who has simply possessed. And by received, by that I mean the type of reception, receiving that includes downloading from the Internet, commercial transactions, if there are such things. Now it's basically free, so I guess people probably don't spend a lot of money on it anymore. But
you know, obviously it's a terrible thing. Those who receive by downloading then are automatically under 2G2.2, and those who possess by production are under 2G2.1. Nobody's under 2G2.4.
Well,
once you get to the sentencing phase of the proceeding.
This case, the home case, would have been under 2G2.4, but for the fact that Mr. Holm, the defendant, at the time of his change of plea, admitted.
Well, not necessarily. You could have put on under a preponderance of the evidence standard after a full trial. Suppose there had been a full trial. He'd never said a word. He never admitted to anything. And you, nonetheless, were successful in proving that he possessed these things, which I'll assume you would have been. Then you would have had a sentencing proceeding. You would have put people on. You would have talked about how these things come to be, how a printout could be there. And I would bet on a preponderance of the evidence standard you could have proved he received them.
Well, the experts that we had were not willing to say that what was contained on the computer, which also was printed out in some of the material on the desk that he had, that in fact was downloaded from the Internet.
But you agreed
did it come into his possession? That's the real question.
But is that important, or is it enough that whether coming by floppy, whether coming by actually taking a hard drive from somebody else's computer and putting it into his computer, or any of the many ways we can imagine it, getting into that computer, it's still a movement from A to B. You know, it's still a receipt.
Well, I don't disagree that someone has to receive that, but proving it is something else. You can't have a possession of something if you hadn't received it, unless you wander into a room, I guess, and just observe it or something like that, somehow exert authority over it. I suppose that's a possibility as well. But I just don't see how, in this instance, with the facts I had, that even in the sentencing hearing context, the court might have made an inference that there was receipt. I don't know, but I could not have proven it. In the sense the court is suggesting here.
Well, the court can rely on inferences, though.
Well, I understand. Yes.
Yeah. So the facts were there. You can, and you're not prohibited from arguing the inference.
No, that's correct.
Sentencing here.
You know, I understand that there is a puzzle in a sense that there is that language there.
Well, there's the language, and there's this whole debate about the semicolon and the lack of a comma. You know, about that last phrase with intent to traffic. That, you know, again has been discussed in a number of decisions, but it's a troublesome structure with these guidelines, especially in light of what Judge Cudahy was mentioning with the amendment. And
the Johnson case, I think, is as close as I could find that addresses this problem, and it's a similar case in that instance where the defendant at the time of his guilty plea admits, up until that point he's only charged with possession, admits that he received, but he also admits that he sent. So it's one additional factor.
Yeah.
And at that point, then, the cross-reference is applied when he's sentenced. So it's very similar to our case in that it wasn't until the time of the guilty plea that the court, and then, of course, the probation office, could go to that next step and say, well, there's more here than just possession, and therefore we're going to get out of 2G2.4, we're going to go to 2G2.2 because of that extra activity.
Of course, that case is covered no matter how you interpret with intent to traffic, because
that's
by
true.
The time he's received and sent it back out, he satisfies even a narrow reading.
That's true.
I'd like to ask you a question about the conditions of probation, which there are a number of cases in other circuits on the subject, nothing in this circuit, I gather. I wanted to ask about the prohibition against any use of the Internet at all. This guy is in the computer business, and that deprives him of a livelihood, doesn't it? Is that a necessary condition, or should there be some discretion left in the probation officer about things like this?
That's a good question. I would certainly stand corrected if I've misunderstood the particular issue that was raised by the defendant, but my approach to this was that the specifics that he complained about, which was he was banned from viewing material that contained nudity, he was not to have contact with those individuals under 18 years of age, and he was to submit to physiological or polygraph testing as part of a sex offender treatment program. I don't think the defendant here in his brief, and I don't think has heard that.
The only place he put it, as far as I can make out, is in the summary of his argument. He didn't address that particular issue.
I think there is another circuit that there was a severe limit, if not a ban, on Internet use by a person who had been involved in this sort of activity.
Can I just ask one other question?
Yes.
About the special condition, the unsupervised visits with people under 18. Now, this wasn't a situation where there had been any kind of sexual misconduct, and isn't that overly broad, a ban and period from unsupervised visits?
Well, two things. I think that to say that...
Or unsupervised contact, I think, is the...
Correct, point. Right. Any contact...
Yeah, so contact visits, I could... You know,
that's Burger King example.
Right, yeah.
The casual contact, I think, is covered by the Lloyd case, and I think that's... You have to read some common sense into what is meant here. But the judge had found that this individual was a sex offender. He called him a sex offender, and that's what his finding was, and that there was a potential that he would act upon his fantasies, years of viewing these child pornography images, and so it's more of a deterrence or a protection for individuals, and I think that's linked to this treatment idea also as a sex offender. So it does on its face appear to be an overstepping or overly broad, but the court made the finding that this person had the potential to go that direction, therefore wanted to protect children.
Yeah, but there was no affirmative, there was no behavior, that was just based on...
No, there was not any in the okay. past, you're correct.
Thank you very much. Yes, Mr. Borthrey.
As far as the definition of trafficking, when I look at 2G2.4C2, trafficking involving receiving, I think of, and this court should think of, somebody who is warehousing a large quantity of material ready to be shipped out. That's not what was happening in this case. Counsel made a comment about the court making a specific finding that Mr. Holm was a sex offender, therefore he should be prohibited from having any contact with anybody under 18. Ashcroft addressed that situation and said, we just can't conclude that child pornography whets the appetite of a potential sex offender. So the court, I think, went too far in that restriction on a supervised release. Thank the court for its time, unless there's any questions.
No, and you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, I was.
The court wishes to thank you very much for your vigorous representation of your client.
Thank you.
All right.